in. Welcome to the first hour of We the People Radio. Today is November 16th, 2025, and I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
Well, bully for you, Bill.
Well, thank you, Aaron.
I guess the only major announcement we have is we switched the dog collars. Thanks, Ellen. They're beautiful. They've got their Christmas colors on today.
Yep.
She's the best.
The year is almost over.
I know, right?
That's amazing.
Okay, so in the spirit of the year is almost over, some things are never over. Never. So Prop 50 is never over. Yay. And we have Mark Moisher on today. We've been telling everybody, and everyone's waiting breathlessly to find out what happened, what is happening, I should say, and what's happened with the lawsuits and stuff. So Mark is an attorney with the Dillon Law Group since 2017, and his bio and all of his great information, along with the shows we have done prior to Prop 15, if you're still confused, or Prop 50, if you are confused about why Prop 50 was a big deal, why you care about it, you live in another state, you're thinking, I don't care, California's all filled with mental people who do stupid things, okay, yes. But we're coming for you next.
Yeah.
And so anyway, it's worth learning about just in case your state pulls a stunt like this. How about that? So Mark, we know you're in the throes of legal beagling, and so we're going to leave it to you to line us out on what's the haps these days.
Yeah, I mean, right now, I've been on your show so many times in the last couple months that I almost wonder if I'm going to become a co-host next.
Well, we're excited about it, so yeah, sure. Sure, do it. We'll adopt you. Either that or our child, but I think you're a little old for that. But I don't know, younger than we are.
Well, we're here to talk about Prop 50, and I unless you have been living under a rock, you heard that on November 4th, Prop 50 passed overwhelmingly. And within 12 hours of it passing, my firm and I filed a complaint in federal district court in which we allege that Prop 50 was a unconstitutional racial gerrymander. So we, less than 12 hours from when the polls closed, we had a fully briefed a complaint on file asking for a federal three-judge panel to decide the issues. And 2 days later, on Friday, we filed our motion for preliminary injunction. And our motion for preliminary injunction is basically asking the court that, based upon the evidence that we are presenting to the court in our motion, it is clear that we are going to prevail on this case, that since we are going to prevail in the case, we are asking the court to enter a preliminary injunction to stop Prop 50 from being enforced in the elections in 2026 while we litigate all the constitutional violations that are associated with Proposition 50. So there's a lot that I just said there. We probably need to unpack it and break it down so everybody understands exactly what's going on here.
Yes, please.
So, first off, Prop 50, let's make sure everybody understands what it is. It is a congressional redistricting. They took California's 52 congressional districts and they changed all the lines so that the people that you voted for in the last election may not actually be your congressman in the next cycle because of how they redrew the line. Now, this is a process, redistricting, that happens every 10 years after the census, and that's actually in our Constitution that states every 10 years must do this redistricting to ensure that as closely as possible, the same number of people are in each state are representing a single congressman. You can't have a congressman just for LA and another one just for Shasta. You know, that would, you know, be unequal representation. So every 10 years, people move and the lines need to draw so that within the state you have equal representation, same amount of people per congressman. So that's kind of the overarching principle of every 10 years. And in the state of California, we have a commission, an independent redistricting commission, and that independent redistricting commission draws the lines. And they do so after, you know, thousands of hours of volunteer time hearing public testimony, and they reach a conclusion. Well, Gavin Newsom and the Democrats do not like that the California Constitution does not allow politics to be a factor in drawing the line. And so as such, in a political move by the legislature, they went out and really quickly drew lines that they like, and they ran it through as a constitutional amendment and got the permission of the people through Prop 50. Now, per Constitution, you know, you can go clear back to the very, very, very beginning of our Constitution. There's always been what we call political gerrymandering. And one of the favorite stories I love to tell is after the United States Constitution was adopted and it was ratified by the states, there was a guy that most people in America have heard of. His name is Patrick Henry. Well, Patrick Henry did not like the Constitution. He thought it gave too much power to the feds and not enough power was retained for the states. And so he wanted to kind of destroy the whole Constitution, but he couldn't do so because it was ratified. So what he wanted to do was a new constitutional convention. Now, in order to get a new constitutional convention, he needed to make sure that he got as many congressmen elected in that first Congress who would immediately ask for a subsequent Congress, or a separate convention, a second constitutional convention. And so, as such, Patrick Henry did some gerrymandering, and he drew the lines in such a way that Virginia's 7th Congressional District, he drew it in such a way that he was sure James Madison would lose an election to James Monroe. And James Monroe was a protege of Patrick Henry, and he drew that line so that way James Madison couldn't get elected, and if James Madison wasn't elected, his opportunity to have that second constitutional convention would be much more likely to happen. Well, the rest of the story is James Madison was a pretty good campaigner, and he beat James Monroe, and he went to Congress, and he actually introduced what became known as the Bill of Rights. And with that history, why I gave all that is because it's political gerrymandering is permitted under the Constitution. What is not permitted under the Constitution is racial gerrymandering. And that is under the 14th and 15th Amendment, what we call the Reconstruction Era Amendment, is that we did not want states to pass laws that benefit somebody based upon the color of their skin. And that includes gerrymandering. You're not allowed to draw a congressional district to benefit or to disadvantage a group of voters based upon their race. So that is kind of the foundation of our lawsuit, because when it was first announced that we were going to be doing this Prop 50 redistricting, there was some legislators that came out and said, they said, Texas did away with the Voting Rights Act. We here in California are going to draw the map to expand the opportunity for minority voters to get elected. Now, understand that in California, 27 of the 52 congressional districts are represented by minority voters. You know, we already have more than 50% of the voters, or 50% of the congressmen in this state, are of a minority racial background. That is one of the blessings of California, is that we are a racially diversified people. But there were legislators who thought it wasn't enough. They needed to be even gerrymander the lines even more based upon race. And when, on April 18th, the maps came out, the Democrat legislatures came out and said, with these maps, we have expanded the voting rights opportunities for minority voters. Now, who paid for these maps? Well, There is some dispute over who paid for it, but we do know that the DCCC did come out and made a payment to a guy named Paul Mitchell, who is the individual who supposedly drafted the map. And the DCCC, you know, paid him for a copy of those maps. They made some suggestions to it, and then they, and that's what they gave to the legislature, which eventually became the Prop 50 maps that everybody voted on. Now, Paul Mitchell did a couple public appearances, and in one of his public appearances, he came out and said, when I was drawing the map, I started in downtown L.A., and there was this particular district I wanted to draw because I wanted to draw in a voting rights district in L.A. for the Hispanic community. And so he basically admitted that when he drew the 52 congressional districts, he started with race as the reason why he was drawing the line. Now, as I said, the Constitution starts out, 14th and 15th Amendment, is that legislatures are not supposed to draw lines based upon race. But there's an exception that the Supreme Court has given, and that exception that the Supreme Court has given is if the state is trying to rectify past discrimination, there is a three-part test that they must follow. This three-part test, if they can prove the three-part test, then and only then are they allowed to draw districts where race is a factor in how they drew those lines. So, again, I just to, you know, I'm moving very fast here. I'm giving a lot of information. I just want to make sure everybody understands it. The overarching principle under the Constitution is that you do not use race. There is a exception to that, which is called the Voting Rights Act. And we need to now break down the Voting Rights Act in the three-part test that it has laid out for when a state is allowed to do a racial gerrymander. And there are three elements of that test, and I'm not going to worry about the first two because we don't think they're at issue here. But the third element of that test is that a white majority votes as a racial block to ensure that the racial minority never is elected. Well, there are three elements to that test. A white majority. Erin, you're a smart girl. Is there a white majority in the state of California?
Actually, at this point, I'd probably say no.
They're not even a plurality.
They
are
really?
The second largest group, racial group in the state,
okay,
behind Hispanics. Hispanics come in about 40%, and whites come in around 32 to 34%. So they're not even there is no such thing as a white majority in the state of California. So we say on black letter law, they fail to prove that there's a white majority.
Because they're trying to counter that, but it isn't even a thing.
Yeah, there is no such thing as a white majority. There's not even a white plurality. All we have is whites are the second largest group, actually behind the Hispanic group. Now, the second element of this test is they vote in a racial block. That means that the overwhelming percentage of whites hate Hispanics so much that it doesn't matter the color of your politics, they are going to vote against you if based upon the color of your skin. So I got to put something before you. Let's go back to 2022. In 2022, we had a guy named Gavin Newsom running for governor against Senator Dawley. Now, I think most people know that both of those individuals are white guys, right?
Yep, Brian Dawley and Gavin Newsom. Yep.
Both white. Now, also for U.S. Senate, there was a race between a guy named Alex Padilla, who is a Hispanic, and a guy named Mark Moiser, who happens to be talking here today, who is a white guy. Now, if we had racial white voting in California, you would assume that white Mark Moiser running against Hispanic Alex Padilla, Mark Moiser would get a lot more votes than white Brian Dolly would get. But the exact opposite is true. Brian Dolly actually got more votes than Mark Moiser, and that's because there is no prejudice or racial voting as a block by whites in the state of California. In fact, there was another race in 2022 which pitted a Hispanic Republican named Jack Guerrero, and Jack Guerrero actually got more votes than Brian Dolly did. So the Hispanic candidate actually got more votes than the white candidates did, and the white candidate who was running against the Hispanic got the least amount of votes of anybody, which means that there is actually no racial block voting in California. If anything, it's actually the opposite, in that the Hispanic voters vote against white candidates. You can make that argument. Now, it's not an argument that we're making in this case. We're just saying that the state cannot prove that there is a white racial voting that prevents Hispanics from getting elected. Now, the third element is that...
Hold that thought, Mark. Let's not break up the third element. We've got to take a really quick break. We'll be right back. And Robert provided us with some sound from a guy named Tim Hawkins. Seemed to fit today. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Everybody, gather around. I'm here to give you anything you like. You want free college, energy, mortgages, whatever you like. You have come to the right place. Why? I'll tell you why. Who can take your money?
Who can take your money?
With a twinkle in their eye.
A twinkle in their eye.
Take it all away and give it to some other guy. The government.
The government.
The government can.
The government can.
Who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the sunrise?
Who can tax the trees? Let you run a business and collect up all the fees. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can, cause they mix it up with lies and make it all taste good.
Make it all taste good.
The government takes everything we make to pay for all of their solutions. Healthcare, climate change, pollution. The Constitution.
Just almost too fitting. Two more verses coming up, too. You have that to look forward to. Back to you, Mark.
Yep.
The third issue.
The third issue.
Okay, again, there are three factors that they have to prove. We're only looking at the third factor, but of the third factor, there are three elements. And so, again, I will just, for those who just joined us, the third factor of what the Supreme Court calls the jingle test is that a white majority votes as a racial block to ensure that the minority is unable to elect candidates. So as we've already discussed, there is no white majority in California, that they do not vote as a racial block. And then the third thing is that the minority is never able to elect candidates of their choosing. Well, we can start with the state of California, the statewide office holders. When we look at it, we have one of the most racially diverse statewide slate of offices. We have three whites, three blacks, three Asians, and two Hispanics. So what I would call a very racially diverse profile. You know, you can look at our congressional delegation. There's like 52 congressmen. 27 of them are of a minority. So the Constitution does not create a quota system that says, well, you have to have exactly as many people of your color, you know, in your representation. That's not how it's supposed to be made. The system is supposed to be that that you draw the lines proportionally, and then that you can do a check and just make sure that you aren't drawing the lines in such a way as to deprive a minority of the right to vote. But absent something like that, you're not supposed to draw lines specifically in mind to assist certain minority groups from ensuring that they are able to elect the candidate of their choice. And so our argument is that this third factor under Jingles, which is the Voting Rights Act, we say that the state has not met that burden. And because they did not meet that burden, the fact that they drew these 16 voting rights districts, of the 52 districts, there are 16 districts that they drew specifically to ensure that a racial minority was able to elect the candidate of their choice, we say that that is an unconstitutional racial gerrymander. And so we have asked the court, don't let the Prop 50 maps go into effect. We say that our case is so strong that we are going to prevail, and that as such, they should allow for the 2026 election the maps drawn by the Redistricting Commission back in 2021. Those are the maps that should govern the 2026 election. So that's a huge mouthful. You've allowed me to go way on. I'll let you kind of follow up on that a little bit.
Yeah, but that makes total. And so, I know you don't have a crystal ball, which is super unfortunate because, well, it's radio and we can say whatever we want, right? They can't see you. But if you had a crystal ball, based on cases that you've seen like this, and I'm sure you guys have done a ton of homework leading up to this, what are the odds of that?
Well, I do not guarantee what a court does, but what we have is, as I mentioned, we have a federal three-judge panel. If the federal three-judge panel does not grant our motion for preliminary injunction, and that is scheduled for December 3rd, so we're going to be in front of the court on December 3rd, we have told the court that we really need their opinion by December 5th, and if they do not rule in our favor, we will do what's called the shadow docket or the rocket docket. We will be filing a petition with the United States Supreme Court. And in that petition, we will say the exact same thing. The state did not meet the test of when they could do a racial gerrymander. And as such, since they have admitted that they did a racial gerrymander, the map of 52 congressional districts associated with Prop 50 needs to be thrown out. And we will ask the court to stay the enforcement of Prop 50 while we go back to the district court, actually go get discovery, do the deposition of all these legislators, put Paul Mitchell on the stand and get his testimony and do all the stuff that you can do before a court issues a final order in a case, that while we are pursuing the entire case, that the Supreme Court enters an order stopping the enforcement of the Prop 50 map. And, I would say that if we can get that in front of the Supreme Court, looking at past cases by the Supreme Court when it comes to keeping the status quo, and that is a very important factor by the Supreme Court, is they don't allow new election laws or new districts come in if it appears to them that the new maps or the new laws might be unconstitutional. They will keep the old law in place. And so the main question will be, and what the state is going to be trying to argue, is they're going to lean in heavily on the fact that, oh, this is not a racial gerrymandering. This was all a political gerrymandering. And political gerrymanderings are allowed, which we can't disagree with. But what we say is, yeah, they may claim that it's a political gerrymandering, but they also are claiming that it's a racial gerrymandering. And racial gerrymanderings are not permitted by the Constitution, regardless of, your intent to do it as a political gerrymandering. You can't violate the law in one way because you have this other intent.
Yeah, that makes sense.
So is what about the fact that the measure violated the Constitution as far as sidestepping the commission? Is that even going to be an issue?
That would be a state constitutional issue that the state Supreme Court could hear and decide on. The federal Supreme Court and the federal courts do not make decisions based upon state constitutional violations. That is reserved for, you know, under our separation of government, that is reserved for the state. That's the power wholly preserved for the state. And before, or not before, you know, right after Prop 50 was signed by the governor, that meant it was going to go to the voters, we did file a writ with the Supreme Court, asking the Supreme Court to stop the election because of all the state constitutional violations. And the Supreme Court said, nah, we won't do that. And so because they did not do that, we're not pursuing any more state constitutional violations. We are focusing fully upon the federal constitutional violation.
So will the federal court, will it have any weight with the federal court that California's Supreme Court didn't want to hear it?
It shouldn't. It is an emotional factor, and, you know, but it, the Supreme Court and the federal courts should not be considering state violations, because the way how that argument would come up is what we call under Article 4, Article 4, Section 4, that, you know, the state, you're guaranteed to live in a state with a Republican form of government. The fact that, you know, the state is violating their state constitution and the state Supreme Court is not following that, that would be an argument for under the, you know, a Republican form of government. The thing is that the Supreme Court long ago ruled that that Republican form of government, that protection that every citizen has to live in a Republican form of government, that is a non-judiciable issue, and thus the only entity that can enforce that provision is Congress itself. That means that Speaker Johnson and the United States Congress, they could come in and they could do something and say, okay, California, by what they did on Prop 50, violated the Republican form of government of the citizens, and as such, we are going to punish you by X, Y, and Z, but the courts are not going to enforce that. So as an attorney, I'm not a congressman. As an attorney, I focus in on what I can do in the federal courts, and that's going to be the 14th and 15th Amendment violations that Gavin Newsom and company did a racial gerrymander. They can try to argue all they want that it's a political gerrymander, but we have so many statements by them that, you know, this was a, they drew the lines for, you know, to advantage a minority group who happens to be the plurality group of the state, but they made these decisions based upon race, and as such, we are arguing that the entire map be not used in the 2026 election while the matter is litigated.
Okay. Yeah, because the practical fact is that if they allow the new maps to go in and then the court reverses that, I mean, let's just say that happened. Okay, so they say, okay, the crazy maps have to go in. Everyone runs, so the calendar is a factor here because the congressional district filing begins beginning of December, ends in March, and then it is what it is. You've declared you're running in district whatever, and they're running. So let's say the court comes back in April or May, and the election in June.
Oh, okay.
Right? Let's say it's prior to that. They come back and they say, oh, okay, yep, you guys did it wrong. We're going back to the old maps. They can't do that, can they?
Nope, you can't. After the, December 19th, as you mentioned, is the date that candidates can pull papers to go get signatures in lieu of a filing fee. Now, whether that, you know, whether the first day of that process is the last day that a court can enter a preliminary injunction, that is not, you know, that is not necessarily, you know, a debate point right this second.
Mm-hmm.
What we are telling the court is that it would create a whole lot less confusion if this decision is known by everybody by December 19th so that everybody can make the decision. Now, what is the absolute last day that a Supreme Court could make a decision? It's probably, you know, a little bit later than December 19th, but how much later? That would technically be up to the Supreme Court to decide that. And, I'd rather they just make a decision by December 19th.
Right. Yeah, because that is super messy. And some of these districts are just, you know, crazy squiggly lines. Are they going to claim that that's, nope, it's just political gerrymandering? And how do you make that case? Like, let's say that they want to defend it because they will defend the whole idea that they are thwarting the will of the people, you know, with the independent commission and all that. It's like, oh, well, we went to the ballot. You know, people decided.
Yeah, and, you know, what I like to remind people who say, you know, popular sovereignty or, you know, the people voted for this. It's like, yeah, well, if you remember Prop 8, the people voted for, you know, the marriage amendment too, and that didn't stop the courts from saying, wait a second, that's unconstitutional. So, you know, the whole concept of this popular sovereignty that is kind of being pushed right now by the loony left, they only like this when it's in their benefit, but, you know, when I remind them of the fact of Prop 8 from a few years ago, all of a sudden they're, you know, they're not very intellectually honest here.
Yeah. Well, that's kind of the thing. So because there would be so much upheaval, so they put in the new maps, the case goes on, you have to appeal it, it goes on, blah, 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 at some point down the pipeline after these maps are put in, after the election is over, could it be overturned? Anything could, but... So what if it was overturned then?
Yeah, would it matter? I mean,
you wait till what, 2028, and you revert back?
Well, see, right now there is a case before the Supreme Court that's called Louisiana versus Calais, and this is dealing with lines that were drawn multiple years ago. So there was a stay entered to keep the status quo, to keep the old maps in place while the litigation happened. They expect that this decision is going to come down at some point in time, and when it comes down, the state of Louisiana is going to have to go redraw its lines or they keep the lines depending upon how that decision comes down. And so that is just one of the factors that is in this whole thing is the stay just determines what lines are in place while the litigation happens. And then once the litigation is over, depending upon that decision, we could be going back to the Prop 50 maps. We could be going to the commission maps, and that's all going to be determined based upon how the federal courts determine whether the use of rape, when they failed the three factors of Jingles, whether that was proper or not. So, obviously, we are strong proponents that the state did a racial gerrymander, and as such, our argument is that the Prop 50 map should not be used in 2026, 2028, or 2030. That is the argument that we are pushing for the court, but what's before the court on the December 3rd hearing is strictly the issue of, for the 2026 election, which set of maps will the state run their elections under.
Now now that's the stay, though, isn't it, on the third?
Yes.
Okay.
Wow, so that's a big day. We're going to hold our breath on that one. We have to take another quick break so we don't have to hold our breath. We're going to go back to our friend Tim and hear the other two verses of his fun song and make fun of the government because, you know, right now that's all we've got. We're going to resort to mocking something we really like. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
And who can give a bailout?
Who can give a bailout?
Tell us to behave.
Tell us to behave.
And make the founding fathers roll over in their grave. The government.
The government.
Oh, the government can.
The government can.
And the government can. Cause they mix it up with lies and make it all taste. Their economics are fictitious. Soon we'll have to eat our dishes.
Delicious.
Oh, who can be a failure?
In so many ways.
Instead of getting fired, hey, we'll give ourselves a raise. The government.
That's the bottom line is, it feels so good because the government says I should. Oh, it's a guy named Tim Hawkins. It's called The Government Can. I'm not going to apologize. You're going to be humming it all day. Worst things could happen. So before we jump back in, I just want you to know that on the November 16th, 2025 website for today, at We the People Radio, I have linked the previous show that we did with Mark. We did a couple of them. I actually aired one of them, the total show, again, because it was important enough before the election. So if you're kind of coming in on this late and you're thinking, I feel like I came in halfway through a movie, go back, listen to that. The maps are posted there. You can see what the districts used to look like, what they look like now. There's also a couple of interactive map versions, one that shows you all the racial makeup. It shows you the political makeup. You can just literally scroll around California, and you can the stats pop up for each of the districts. It's very easy to use, and it's all posted right there for you. So I would encourage you to go kind of get familiar with that. So, Mark, we came up with we were talking in the break, and we realized, what about the geography? Because that new District 2 that we just happened to live in, the green one at the top of the state, so it takes some of the counties at the top of the state, but then it rolls all the way down the coastline to Marin County, and apparently at some points it's only like a few miles wide. How will they make, I mean, is that a factor? Can you use that?
What you're referring to is what I call the misshaped Tetris block.
The old misshaped Tetris block ploy.
And the answer is, there is no racial gerrymandering associated with that particular district. They did not draw the lines that in a way that I could prove in court of law,
right,
racially. So as such, that particular district is probably, you know, I would have to admit in a court of law, is a political gerrymander. Now, what it matters is, okay, so that was a political gerrymander.
Is there insanity gerrymandering? Is there a category for that?
Unfortunately, no.
Oh, too bad.
So the fact is that there are these 16 other districts that are racially gerrymandered.
Sure.
And the fact is that because they are unconstitutional, you can't just say, oh, well, those 16 people don't have congressional districts because the other ones are good. No, the entire map must be thrown out because, you know, they drew so many lines that were unconstitutional. And you have to go back and draw new lines, but there's no mechanism to... The legislature can't just go draw a new set of maps because, you know, they would have to get approved by the voters. So our argument is the line drawn by the legislature, and by the way, ignorance of the law is no excuse, right? So These legislatures should have known what the law was. They didn't follow the law as currently applied by the United States Supreme Court. They failed to follow the law. And as such, it goes back to the commission map. And the commission, the maps that are currently in place, those are the ones that should be enforced for the 2026 election. That is the argument that we are going to be making.
So the 16 districts you said that are racially divided, were they all altered to produce this new map, or were some of them already in place?
There's been some movement, but the Supreme Court has said even if you move the line one block, if you're moving it one block for racial purposes, mm-hmm. you have to justify it. So the fact that about 30% of the lines changed, and as a result of those lines changing, they basically came out with this analysis that they said, okay, 16 districts have been drawn with race to benefit a racial minority. Our argument is that the legislature had a duty to go in and do this analysis and say, you know, are these lines necessary in order to, you know, satisfy past discrimination? Is it to solve a racial block voting problem? And they didn't do that. And because they didn't do that, we say the entire map has to be thrown out. As I said, ignorance of the law is no excuse. You can't just say, well, this is what we want. No. Legislature, just like, you know, Erin, when she's driving home from the studio today, has to follow the law, and she can't tell an officer, oh, I didn't know the speed limit was 25 miles an hour here through the school zone. You know, ignorance of the law is no excuse. So likewise, the legislature, they can't claim, oh, well, we didn't know that we couldn't do racial gerrymandering. No, it's pretty clear that you can't do it.
Yeah, and it's pretty clear you did it for a specific reason. Are there any other cases going on this topic?
In California, no. There is the Louisiana case that I told you about that was before the Supreme Court. They argued it on October 15th. We are anticipating, you know, sometime in the next month or two, probably by the end of January, but they could be as late as June, some kind of decision on the Louisiana map. And one of the issues before the court on that Louisiana case is what they say is an unconstitutional, what they're arguing is that drawing Voter Rights Act districts, period, end discussion, violates the 14th and 15th Amendment. Mm. So they're kind of making an argument, yeah, it may have been necessary in the 1860s and even in the 1960s, but that's not the world that we live in now. And as such, you know, legislatures that are drawing these racial districts in some kind of quota mindset is like, okay, we have X amount of population, now we have to draw X amount of districts. That is before the Supreme Court at this point in time, whether that whole practice of VRA is constitutional. But our case is a little different. It's basically says, regardless of what the Supreme Court says the VRA is, California did not meet that standard. They did not, you know, they didn't fulfill that three-part test. And so regardless of whether the Supreme Court says VRA districts can be drawn or can't be drawn, these lines were drawn under the current law in such a way that violated the Constitution.
Okay. Wow.
Well, it sounds pretty cut and dry. I don't know. What's your gut feeling on this? Is the court, do you think they're going to kind of go the way of the California Supreme Court?
What kind of odds is Jimmy the Greek giving you?
Yeah. I mean, it's,
I am a lawyer. I believe in my case. I'm going to zealously advocate my case all the way to the Supreme Court if necessary. And I'm cautiously optimistic. And I do not give percentages. I just say I'm cautiously optimistic.
Yeah. Okay. And then does this, I'm thinking that this will help all of this, you know, Louisiana helps us, helps the next, because I think they're planning on doing this in other states if they haven't already. I have not kept up with that. Are other legislatures rolling this same sort of program?
As we've heard, Texas has already redistricted, and there are several other states looking at redistricting proposals. And, you know, any decision by the court as to when you can racially gerrymander or when you can't racially gerrymander will have a play. Now, the thing is, when Texas drew their map, they had a hearing last month, and a part of that hearing, the person who drew the map got off on the stand. And he basically said, when I was drawing the lines, I did not look at the race of anybody. Instead, I never looked at that. I just drew the lines based upon politics and drew the lines the way that I thought, you know, best benefited the, you know, people of Texas and the will of the Texas legislature. And then that map was given off to, you know, a third-party lawyer who looked at it to make sure that none of the lines drawn created some kind of VRA problem or, you know, basically discriminated against the minority by taking a large group of minorities and cracking them into multiple districts so that they couldn't elect anybody. So, and that attorney basically came back and said, nope, you didn't violate the VRA. So that's how Texas did it. They actually drew the lines without considering race to begin with. Unlike what, you know, California did, where they said, let's start with race and let's see how many districts we can draw.
Wow. It's, as for those of us who live here, it's distressing. And the other factor that isn't a factor, but really does make a difference for the people who live here is this rural versus urban divide. That district two at the top of the state. If people have not seen these maps, I don't really care where you live. You should go click on the page for today and look at the map. The green district at the top of the state goes from the northeast corner of California all the way down to Marin County on the coast. The top northeast corner county is Modoc. They voted, I haven't looked at the recent numbers, but it was basically 80-20 against this. And Marin County voted 80-20 for this. Marin County is obviously very, very urban. And Modoc County is actually classified as frontier. So we have urban, we have rural, and we have frontier. Modoc is a frontier county, and they are now attached to Marin. I mean, what kind of representation will they get?
I will tell you this. When you look at the maps of the state and you look at the weird districts, you know, you usually have one or you have two. And that is because, generally speaking, there, you know, as you're kind of drawing these lines and you're trying to draw it equal, you kind of end up with one or two districts at the end that are kind of get these squishy look because they're kind of being... they're the last ones there. You draw the rest of the map, and it's like, what's over? Okay, you get this squish district.
Because they all have to have the same number of people, I guess, for people that don't speak redistricting. We have to make sure and tell them that the goal in this is that all the districts have the same number of people. So sometimes you have to squiggle the lines around to go grab up more, because you need more bodies.
Yes. And so it's not unusual to see one or two weird-looking districts. And the California map that we had by the redistricting commission, there were two districts that one I called the backwards E and one I called the W district. It was very clear that they were kind of the everything else district. Now, the new set of maps that Gavin has drawn, I have about 20 different maps that just have really funny shapes. The pouncing puppy in San Diego, the Snoopy in Orange County. The desert monster out in the Palm Desert area. We have the Valley Varmint in the Central Valley. You know, the mixed up Tetris piece in Northern California. There's the elephant, the Sierra Snout, coming out of, which is the Kevin Kiley district. It's just, when you look at it, these are just some of the most atrocious shaped districts I have ever seen.
Yeah.
It does not follow any traditional notions of redistricting, but, you know, it is very clear that there was some very ugly drawing that was going on. But we are focusing we are keeping our focus on the main constitutional violation, that there are the 16 congressional districts that were drawn with race as the race as a factor.
Well, I think that's fairly clear, and so we're down in the last 50 seconds here, but we really appreciate it, Mark. I know you were super busy today, but on the heels of this, and we've been talking about it so much, I thought it was important that people hear from you and get it straight from the horse's mouth, as it were.
Oh.
Those of us in the Tetris area, we appreciate your work. So, fingers crossed, and we will have you back when we get closer to court, huh?
Sounds like a plan. As it sounds to me, like I'm becoming a regular co-host of this program.
Yeah, you can have a sleepover anytime. We've got a spare room. we're speaking with Mark Moisher. This has been About Prop 50. You can find it all at
wethepeopleradio.us.
You know there ain't no rest for the wicked. Money don't grow on trees. We got bills to pay, we got mouths to feed. There ain't nothing in this world for free. I know we can't slow down, we can't hold back. Though you know we wish we could. I know there ain't no rest for the wicked until we close our eyes for good.
Good afternoon, and welcome to the second half of We the People Radio here on October the 12th, 2025. My name is Aaron Ryan.
My name is Bill Cundiff.
And dun, 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 we have Alan Gelso with us. Yay. I read the snippet about his books some time back, and I thought, we have to cover this. And I'm positive he can't do this in a minute and a half, so we have an entire hour minus commercial, little commercial breaks, but the title of the book, actually, is The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, and it's a two-volume set. I believe it is a textbook. He is the Thomas W. Smith Distinguished Research Scholar in the James Madison Program in American Ideals and Institutions and a faculty member at Princeton University. He's the co-author of this new textbook, The Golden Thread. I just think that this is something, the timing is so great. And the title of the article that was sent to me said, "Why Are Americans Ignorant of Our Own History?" And I thought, amen, right?
Yeah.
Let's get him on there. And then I searched for some pictures, as I told you last week, and I found this one wearing a dashing red tie and kind of a smirk. So, Alan, the picture I'm looking at of you has a little smirk on it, and I understand last week you were moving. I'm sure your smirk was gone by the end of that ordeal.
Well, I'm surprised that I would smirk. Usually I'm a pretty sober-looking character.
I know. That's why I picked the smirky one. You kind of look a little bit like Kelsey Grammer. It's kind of that sort of smirk.
Oh, dear. If I had a dime for every person who has asked me over the last 30 years, do you know that you look like Fraser?
It's pretty funny.
Oh, I know, and I've had more than a few interesting events occur. Probably the most interesting was the day I walked into a news agency. I was going to buy a newspaper. The man behind the counter looked at me and said, "You're Fraser, aren't you?" And I said,
"You're all,
no."
Yeah.
And I said, "Well, no." And then he responded by saying, "Oh, I understand. You can't say that in public." and then he dived down below the counter and came up with a camera and took my picture.
Nice.
So suddenly I had celebrity thrust upon me.
I like it. Well, you know the Kelsey Grammer, like, kind of little half smile. Picture is that. And I thought, that is just fun. Especially for someone who wrote a book about the history of the world, I mean, I figured, well, you know.
The curious thing is, I've never met Kelsey Grammer. Maybe someone in your listening audience can broker some kind of rapprochement between us. But I've never met the man. And this makes it even a stranger. I've never watched any of the shows that he has been in because I'm just not a television watcher.
Sure.
I wouldn't have the time.
Even if you're on the show,
Yeah, so to speak. So when people would say things like that to me, I wasn't entirely sure. Is that a compliment or an insult? Well, I finally figured out, all right, it's a compliment. So I'm reasonably content for people to ask me that question without biting anybody's head off.
Well, the good part is at least he's smart. I mean, it wasn't one of those comedies that was a bunch of, intestinal jokes or whatever. It's actually a very smart show, and it was very funny. But I just kind of chuckled because we interviewed a guy. His topic was very sober too. He was a murder investigator, and there's a picture of him, and he looks like 007. And I was like,
oh my goodness!
I love knowing people just through their pictures on the internet. It's kind of fun.
It can be a little risky. You might draw the wrong conclusion.
I know.
If a photographer catches someone at the wrong angle or at the wrong moment, and that can send all kinds of shockwaves through the blogosphere.
Yeah, so I kind of go through the, just look at the preponderance of the pictures, and yours were very serious, but this one was fun, and I thought, we're fun, so you'll be fun, and this would be a good representation for this.
I will, as Jeeves said, I will do my best to give satisfaction.
Exactly. Okay, so is there an answer, or is it a two-volume answer to why are Americans ignorant of our own history? Did you ever get to the root of that?
I think we addressed that actually pretty frankly right at the very beginning in the introduction to the two-volume set. The two volumes were written by myself. Actually, I wrote the bulk of volume two. And volume one was written by my co-author and friend of many, many years, James Hankins of Harvard. Hankins and I have known each other since, quite literally, since high school. And not only that, we were even in marching band together, believe it or not. So we have a long history over these five decades and more of constant conversation. And when someone asked me, how long did it take you two to write this? The answer was like, well, we've really been at this for about the last 50 years. So the actual mechanics of writing, maybe about 5 years. But the issues, the questions, all of these things are things we have talked about for all of those years. So what we have tried to address and had to address, both in the books and in our professional lives, is this question, why don't people know more about history? And I think there's several reasons for that. One is that there has occurred a crisis of sorts in this thing we call Western civilization. There's a kind of indifference. Because we have learned by means of mass communication, we've learned how big the world is, and we feel that we have to accommodate all of it to do justice to it. And in accommodating all the other histories that it's possible to accommodate, we have to make some room and shorten the attention span that's devoted to Western history and to American history in particular. Sometimes the indifference, though, is there because there are people who believe that all history is really just superstructure. It really isn't about real things like the acquisition of power or economic forces. And then there's sometimes, quite frankly, there are people who are just simply openly hostile to Western civilization, to American history in particular, within Western civilization, because they blame it for quite a grocery list of evils, genocide, colonialism, imperialism, slavery, racism, sexism, as though these were not present in other places, which of course they are. It's not that these are unique in the experience of Americans or in the experience of Western civilization. So I think in many respects, there are a multitude of reasons for this moment when we feel like we have suffered from a kind of cultural Alzheimer's and our memory has gone blank, or if not entirely blank, at least mostly blank, about the things that are really very important for us. So these two books are really a recall. They are a stimulation, a revitalization of our memory of who we are and how we got to where we are. And that's why we focus our title on one particular famous myth from Greek classical history. The golden thread is really about how Theseus finds his way out of the labyrinth after he has slain the evil Minotaur. The golden thread is what he finds as his passageway out of the labyrinth into the light of day. And what we are encouraging people to do through these books is, once again, find a way out of the darkness of the labyrinth into which we've allowed our memory to lapse, and follow that golden thread to the light, to the present, to our current situation, and bring with it all the riches of the past in terms not just of history, but also of culture, of literature, of art. These two books, these are big books. They're big because they're chock full of illustrative material, of art, of charts, of primary sources. In a sense, we want people to be able to dip into these books and have a sense that they are meeting their own civilization.
Mm-hmm. Well, I'm always fascinated by history, and one of the things that I think people kind of lose sight of is when you talk about world history, I mean, written history goes back forever. Our history is only 250 years old. You go beyond that, and the things that were going on in the world prior, I mean, 1500, 1400, 1300, it's all written down. And we weren't
in the game.
We weren't even in the game. We weren't even thought of when all this was happening. And that always just kind of fascinates me when you put it in perspective.
Look at it in the long term, and we are still in what you might call, as a nation, our adolescence.
Yeah.
Sometimes with all the problems of adolescence. Adolescents don't have a particularly good grasp, let's say, on the experience of their parents. In fact, by the time you get to 14, 15, 16, 17, hey, you don't want to be seen doing the things your parents did. You really don't think that the experience of your parents is all that relevant to you and your friends.
Right.
Then you get a little bit older, you go to school, you acquire a life of your own, and as Mark Twain once said, it is absolutely amazing how much your parents have learned by the time you turn 22.
That is so true.
Yeah, they get smarter as you get older.
They really get smarter.
Yeah. So in this case, what we are in is a kind of intellectual adolescence, and what these books are a way of doing is helping us get to the mature stance that understands exactly how we got where we are today and what we have gained by it, and also what we've lost along the way and can and should retrieve. So these books are a guide cast in the form of history, of two volumes worth of history, because both Hankins and I are historians, professionally speaking. But it's also a recovery of the whole notion of what it is to be part of a civilization. And simply unpacking the word civilization gives us some fairly good ideas of what is contained in that effort.
Well, and where will this, where will your textbook, is it an option for, you know, universities? I realize people can actually, regular people that aren't in college can buy it, but...
Yeah, in large measure, Hankins and I have aimed the books themselves for students in upper division high school surveys, AP surveys of various sorts, maybe 11th if they're really, really good, but 12th grade, or for first-year college surveys. And we've already had inquiries from colleges and universities who are thinking about adopting the golden thread for Western civilization survey courses. So that is the audience that we're really looking at, although, truth be told, these are the kind of books that can really be picked up by almost anyone. You don't have to be 18, 19, 20. You can be two or three times that and still pick these books up and find elements of interest in the narrative, in the excerpts from the original sources, in the artwork that is reproduced here and discussed, even the discussion of music. Now, in a book, you can't play music, but in a book, you can describe music. So, for instance, in Volume 2, I have separate sections talking about Claudio Monteverdi, talking about Giovanni Gabrieli, about Tchaikovsky, about Brahms, about Wagner. I devote, in fact, a whole chapter to the individual whom I consider the greatest of Western musicians in anything remotely related to modern times, and that is Johann Sebastian Bach. So all of these things are in these books, and they are there for anyone at any age level to access. So art, music, and the historical narrative, these are all combined in these volumes.
I think, honestly, I think it's really worth hitting home the fact that we have lost track of some of our history, and some of it is, well, I'll be kind. How about it's not being taught accurately? There's a little bit of that going on, a lot of that going on, which is sparking all sorts of revolutionary ideas that aren't really revolutionary. They're just kind of based on lack of historical knowledge. Maybe we can hit that when we come back. Sorry, I just looked at the time. We have to take a really quick break, but we're going to be back with Alan Gelzo and the books that he has written with James Hankins, The Golden Thread, A History of Western Tradition, of the Western Tradition. And stick with us. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
It's our time to take a stand. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
There's a call. Remember who we are.
Remember who we are.
We were a city on a hill, a candle in the dark. It started long ago. Now we have come so far. We keep our faith, and there's no way out. Where there's little hope, we show no doubt. We know. A price to be free. Remember who we are. With our blood, sweat, and tears. Remember who we are. Will our children be the ones asking us one day why we didn't do enough, why we gave it all away?
So your book might not have any music in it, but we found some. And
well, that worked. There's a message there, and the message is who we are is who we were.
Yeah.
And a sense of understanding that is critical to the life of any society. I remember many years ago, Alexander Solzhenitsyn, in his great opus, The Gulag Archipelago, made the comment that the first strategy of tyrants and dictators is to erase the history of the people that they conquer.
Yep.
Because then people have nothing to compare the past and the present with. They have no way of looking at their current situation and saying, look, this is wildly different and much worse than it was in the past. And if you don't have that as a guide, if you don't have that as an incentive, then you're not going to trouble the waters for the tyrants and the dictators who are ruling you. And that's, of course, exactly what the tyrants and dictators want. They want to erase the past because it gives you no basis of comparison for understanding your situation in the present.
Yes, and I would imagine it's very difficult since you've spent so much time caring about and researching and documenting all of these things. It's probably pretty tough to watch the conclusions that some of our, especially college-age students, have found with communism and all of those things. It's like,
oh yeah, yeah.
Like you want to just bang your head on a table. It's like, have you never read anything? What the heck?
Well, sometimes the answer to that question is no, they haven't.
sometimes it's right in front of our face, isn't it?
Right, but let me take a step beyond that. That's sort of a knee-jerk response. I want to be perfectly frank and say that there are things that have happened in the experience of the Western nations, which is to say Europe, the United States, and all of the, let's call them the appendages of European civilization, Australia, New Zealand, South America. There are things that have happened in the life of just the last century and two decades that are pretty nasty affairs. Two world wars, some shameless exploitation. And in that respect, it's no wonder that guilt and pity play such a large role in the way people are educated today and are instructed to be ashamed of the past of their own cultures. And so it's not difficult to come up with a bill of indictment. You can put a lot of things on it, all the way from the Western Front in 1914 to 1918, to atomic bombs in World War II, to the concentration camps and the Holocaust, to the Gulag. And you can look at everything that's happened in the last 100, 120 years, and you could say, goodness sakes, this thing called Western civilization really looks like a crock. So if people are disenchanted, there are some good reasons. On the other hand, in the past of Western civilization, there have also been moments of great loss when it looked like the whole thing was going to come apart. When the Roman Empire collapsed, it really seemed at that moment that everything that had gone into the making of the Western tradition, which is to say the civilization of the Greeks, the civilization of the Romans, was going to be hopelessly lost. And in fact, we did lose large chunks of it. But we managed to get by, as Kenneth Clark remarked many years ago, by the skin of our teeth. We recovered those elements of civilization that were so close to being lost. All right, that was one occasion. Another occasion was after the Great Plague of the 14th century, which costs the life of something like two-thirds of the European population. And we talk about a pandemic, and we talk about people getting shots and masks. Well, there weren't shots and there weren't masks, and the bubonic plague was infinitely more deadly than COVID. That was a moment when, once again, Western civilization seemed just to teeter on the brink of dropping into the abyss. Mm-hmm. And we almost did it again, 300 years later, with the religious wars of the 17th century, and especially the great 30 Years' War, when it seemed like everyone had forgotten what it was to be civilized and was behaving like barbarians. So there have been these moments in the past, but we have recovered from them. And we are looking at a moment when, yes, there has been, over the last century, a lot of the same loss. But we can recover this again, and it is important for us to recover the great things of Western civilization, because the alternative to civilization, quite literally, is barbarism. And do we want to be ruled by something we would call barbarism? I would define barbarism fundamentally as the worship of power.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have to characterize that worship of power. What it involves in is total loss of self-control. Everyone just behaves according to impulse, and usually very destructive impulse. There's the development of destructive religions, sometimes anti-religions, and we can see this as an aspect of barbarism. Another way that you can talk about barbarism is about illiteracy. Illiteracy, and with illiteracy, indifference to the past. Because what else is literacy but a way of holding off indifference and loss of memory of the past? That's why we write things down. Because you and I can't remember everything. And even the things we do remember are going to perish with us. Why do we write things down? Because we want the things that are written to endure. But barbarism takes that as an enemy and destroys it.
Right.
And I think above all, barbarism looks a certain way. Barbarism looks ugly. It's ugliness in art. It's ugliness in literature. It's ugliness in music. It's ugliness in architecture.
Mm-hmm.
All of those things fundamentally are based on a worship of power. And that's what constitutes barbarism. Is that what we want to live under? I don't think so.
No.
So if we want to escape the appeal of barbarism, and the appeal of barbarism is out there, all you got to do is look out the window, mm-hmm. and you can see the examples of the threat of barbaric thinking. If we want to avoid being ruled by barbarism, then the alternative is civilization, at which point you want to say, all right, tell us about civilization. That's what these two books are about.
Do you think, you talk about these periods of great loss, do you think civilization needs to go through those periods of great loss in order to kind of regroup and come back stronger and better?
That would almost be like saying that it's good for a human body to go through cholera, smallpox, and malaria in order to become stronger.
Right. But we continue to do it.
Well, yes, but we don't do it as a plan. We don't say, okay, we're 12 years old. Now, here's smallpox. This will be good for you, whether you like it or not. That's really not what we do. We understand that there are better ways to live. And especially when we think about what it costs to make a comeback. I mean, on the one hand, yes, you can say it's a remarkable feature of the Western tradition that it has the kind of resilience that allows it to stage these recoveries. That's really remarkable in its own right. But the price that gets paid along the way, that's not something you want to invite. You might want to say, I'm not sure I want to endorse it, but you might want to say, well, this is inevitable. Everything goes through this kind of cycle. Yes, perhaps, but even if you grant the legitimacy of talking about cycles in history, it's not a pleasant thing that you want to invite on people. And above all, what if the cycle goes off the rails? What if, in fact, the cycle becomes so destructive that the civilizational values themselves, this time, get completely lost? That's not a chance you want to take. It's not an era that you want to live through.
No, that's an excellent point.
You know, you hear people talk about, they think they have it terrible right now, which I have a hard time with. But, we're going to go through another civil war. We need another civil war to get this straightened out. Where's that come from? I mean, it was so destructive. I mean, we're still feeling the effects of the last civil war, and yet people want to go through that again. How do you explain that?
Well, I think sometimes it's because they're trying to think of the most readily available cataclysm that Americans have experienced. And the one that pops up most easily on the screen is the Civil War. They might just as easily say the Great Depression or the First World War. But they come up with the Civil War because that's what comes up most readily.
Mm-hmm.
Are we going to have another Civil War? I'm very dubious about this. At least, we're not going to have a civil war in the same sense that we had it in 1861.
Right. No, there's no way.
Yeah, we're not marching around with single-shot, muzzle-loading muskets that fire black powder. that's not going to happen.
Well, every person who ever tells me that, I finally stopped having the, you know, getting into the weeds on, you know, what the mechanics, and I just cut right to the chase. Okay, let's agree we're having it. Starts tomorrow. What's that look like?
Most of the time we couldn't say.
And then the silence ensues, and the debate is over, and they realize, we're probably not doing that.
Right. It sounds profound to talk about. It even sounds impressive. But is there any substance in it? No. Now, having said that, is it possible we would go through a period of great political disruption? Now that's another story.
Yeah.
And that becomes a possibility that we all have to think about, that we all have to cope with. I think fundamentally, the American imagination is so thoroughly wedded to this idea of democracy, is so thoroughly wedded to its constancy and its survival, that I don't think Americans are going to cheerfully throw that away and say, simply because I disagree with my neighbor, ergo, I'm going to draw an international boundary line around the backyard. That is not going to happen. That is not, it's not practicable, and it's not even really feasible.
So how do you explain this shift in our political landscape towards socialism? When you look at the history of socialism, communism, whatever you want to call it, it always fails. And yet we have so many people that are willing to look at that and
their answer is always, didn't do it right.
Yeah, we'll do
we
it different.
We can do it a different way.
Right. So another million casualties.
Right.
It's going to sound peculiar for me to put it this way, but this is one of the casualties of historical ignorance.
Mm-hmm.
I agree.
Because what makes the communist alternative compelling to people? Is it because it has demonstrated great economic success? Right. Sure.
Zero chance there.
Even if we say, all right, we're going to have it in a somewhat modified form, we're going to have the great socialist experiment. Fine, take a look at the great socialist experiments. Tell me how much great economic success there is. Now, people will sometimes pop up and say, yeah, but look at Britain, the National Health Service, everybody gets free health care. Well, yeah, everyone gets free health care approximately 3 months after they're dead.
Yeah.
So what exactly is it we're talking about? Why? It's not the practical results of socialism or communism that attract people. It's a theory of history. Because what else is Marx? I mean, everything else that Marx described in his writings that speaks to economics has failed. But one thing which abides, and that is the appeal of Marx saying, I know why historical change happens. Historical change happens because there's change in the economic forces at work in the lives of cultures and countries. What are the great markers, historically speaking? Well, there was feudalism, and then there was this bourgeoisie, this middle class, and the middle class overthrew feudalism and replaced it with capitalism. All right, what's going to happen next? The working class is going to overthrow the bourgeoisie and capitalism, and it's going to set up the socialist paradise. Of course, Marx never said what might happen after that, but what people have been enchanted by is this notion that Marx has given them the explanation for why things have occurred in the past and why they are going to occur in a certain pattern in the future. Fundamentally, economics is not what makes Marxism attractive, because there's been so many failures. What continues to make Marxism attractive is it offers to explain why events change in history, and they change because they change on the basis of economic forces and the movement of economic forces and economic classes. It is the enchantment, so to speak, of that historical vision which keeps Marxism alive for people, even when they know very well that there's no economic substance, no economic theory, nothing that is going to guarantee the prosperity of people. To the contrary, it's not prosperity that they're after. What it is a sense of being on the right side of history.
Mm-hmm.
And given that as its attraction, people will embrace that. They will throw away the other histories of their nations and of their civilization to embrace the Marxist theory of history. If you would like to put Marxism in the refrigerator where it never needs to come out again, then the way to do it is to strike at it as a theory of history, as an understanding, as a way of explaining history, because that is the thing which keeps it alive.
Mm-hmm. How do you...
Because there is no free lunch.
No.
And so they're always promising all these things that...
Well, and everybody likes free stuff.
Are never coming.
Yeah, we're
going to do all these free things. And it's like, it always blows my mind that adults will fall for that. Because where in our lives is that even true? Oh, my gosh, it's 1:41. Alan, you're causing us to time travel. I hope you're happy.
Well, that's sort of part of my job description.
That's where the smirk comes in. That's what's happening. We are experiencing that. All right, we've got to take another really quick break. We're going to come right back. Our guest is Alan Gelzo, and the book is not The History of the World Part 2, but that's what I hear in the back of my mind, The Golden Thread, A History of the Western Tradition. And it's a two-volume set, and I think we should make everyone read it.
Yeah, it should be.
Let's talk about
mandatory
freedom and force everyone to read a book. So, really quick break. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. You can find us at wethepeopleradio.us.
Trees of green, red roses too. I see them bloom for me and you. And I think to myself, what a wonderful world.
Ah, yes. Until you delve into the details.
Yeah. Let me take off my rose-colored glasses here. I have a question. How do you see the, you know, with all this advanced technology that's coming on board, seems like daily we're hearing of new tech, how do you see that influencing or guiding the direction of our society?
So you want him to write a third book about the future?
No, but everything seems to be moving so fast right now. And I know every civilization and every era has its own technology. But I'm just curious with what we, you know, with the AI and computers and so forth, where do you see that guiding us?
Well, it's curious because as Robert Fulton's steamboat, the Clermont, was beating its way up the Hudson River at about 6 miles an hour, people on the deck of the Clermont were possessed with panic. We've never gone this fast before.
Yeah.
All right, 6 miles an hour, okay? At that point, that was what really seemed to be almost impossible for people to achieve, much less to be able to continue to breathe. And yet we got over it pretty quickly. Technological change has always been with us, especially it's been with us over the last 300, 400 years. And in particular, since the middle of the 19th century, with the development of the electrical telegraph, we have moved more and more and more towards electronic-based innovations. And we will continue to do that. They will disturb us at moments, the same way they disturbed, the same way the electrical telegraph disturbed people when it was introduced, when the telephone was introduced only a few decades after that. But when you lit up cities with the incandescent light bulb I mean, that was disturbing in its own right. Yet at the same time, we learn how to accommodate and work around these things. Is there going to come a moment in the development of technology today when we are not able to, when the technology finally defeats us? I think that is going to require more of a prophet than I am to say, because there's a good deal in the world of modern technological developments which is very problematic. Look at the amount of time people devote to screens, especially adolescents, mm-hmm. and look at the damage it does. The studies that have been done about the rates of anxiety and depression that are generated by kids who are glued to their smartphones all the time, this is serious and it's disturbing. Is it, however, the end of an age? That, I think, remains to be seen. We have encountered extraordinary technologies before, and they've changed tremendous amounts in short periods of time in people's lives. But we have found ways of accommodating those changes, and we found ways of internalizing coping mechanisms for them. So if we've done that in the past, all right, let's wait and see. We may find exactly those ways for the future. That is as much as a peek behind the curtain of the future as I think anybody can decently give. Otherwise, a great deal of this becomes doomsaying. Because doomsaying gets more attention. If I tell you that tomorrow everything is going to be cool, are you going to sit up nights worrying about it? Are you going to do something about it? No. But if I tell you that tomorrow there's going to be an electromagnetic pulse that's going to fry up every piece of electronic equipment on planet Earth, you are going to do things, and probably you're going to buy things that I tell you to buy. There's much more of a profit margin to doom than there is to peace. This is why people peddle doom much more vigorously than they peddle peace.
Oh, sure. I look at, when you talk about the smartphone technology, I think part of the reason people aren't as educated in history in the past is they don't have to be. They can pick up their cell phone and they can, if somebody asks them a question, they can look it up. AI will tell them the answer in seconds, so.
It'll be the wrong answer, but.
yeah, but they won't know that.
Well, this is true.
Ignorance is bliss, Volume 3.
But I think that's where I think it's, I don't want to say dumbing down, but I think that's exactly what's happening to a lot of our society, and particularly our younger generation.
I'm going to push some chips on the table and say Alan concurs.
Yeah.
Well, let me put it this way. Is it not strange that today we have simultaneously this extraordinary obsession with technology and technological development, at the same time as we have a real loss of belief and confidence in science?
Yes.
So that you have theories of science which completely subvert any notion of predictability, any notion of regularity. I can get into the weeds on some of this. I can drop names like Heisenberg and Thomas Kuhn and people like that. It's the sort of thing that provoked the response from Einstein, that his protest, God does not play with dice. And yet, all of our notions of science today and philosophy of science seem to be marching away from any confidence or belief at the same time as we're putting all our chips in the development of various kinds of technology. And of course, now all the current craze is for AI.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I guess it's like any generation that is confronted with new technology. It is a little frightening. And
all the more reason to come back to this idea of picking up the golden thread of the Western tradition. And we use, by the way, we use the word tradition rather than civilization, because the Western tradition is really a collection of civilizations. You might think of it as kind of archaeological layers. So there is a Greek civilization that we begin with the Battle of Marathon. And then piled on top of that, absorbing that, is the Roman civilization. Then on that, the medieval civilization. Then on that, the civilization of the Enlightenment, and so on. So there is a tradition, because all of these civilizations work together as layers in the creation of this tradition. And I think it's important that we recover that as a counterbalance to the obsession with technology, to the threat of barbarism, because what this Western tradition does is it puts us back to language and literature, puts us back to the written word, it puts us back to decision-making, to what's sometimes called the argument for the sake of heaven. It puts us back to government and law and the impulse for freedom, and it puts us back to faith and art, and above all to resilience, because the great thing about this Western tradition over and over again at its moments of crisis is the capacity that it has shown for self-criticism and for renewal. And it's building on that capacity for self-criticism, of acknowledging, yes, in the Western past, in the American past, there have been some dreadful mistakes. There have been some embarrassing, dreadfully embarrassing moments. Nevertheless, over and over again, our capacity for self-criticism has allowed us to turn those moments of embarrassment, of almost self-contradiction, into forces for the good. So take all those things together, and this Western tradition is something that we need in an environment when barbaric attitudes, the worship of power, mm-hmm. and the obsession with technology threaten to overwhelm us. That is why the Western tradition, we have the imperative here to recover its strengths and its virtues, because it is that which time and again in the past have rescued us from the abyss and can rescue us again from an abyss of the worship of power and the obsession with technology. So that's why these books are here, to help us along the path of that golden thread.
I think, and here at the end of what we got from Stephen Manfredi, your publicist, he just always finds us the most amazing people. People ask all the time, where do you find all these people? I'm like, I don't. I just have friends. Viva la friends. So this, he says here, as Gelzo and Hankins conclude, this indeed is the great test that Western civilization faces in our time. We need to find a new balance between tradition and innovation, to modernize with moderation, without losing that inheritance of immeasurable value that we call the Western tradition. And it's like, yes, that.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And that is, I think that is something that rings true, would ring true for most people, and yet so much of it has become, it's like the addiction to noise.
I think that if people could sometimes sample the extraordinary products of a great Italian chef, they would suddenly say, why haven't I ever had a dinner like this before?
Mm-hmm.
Or if they were to sample some marvelous French wine, they would say, why have I never encountered something like this before? I think they could do the same thing by encountering the literature of great writers and the art of great artists and the music of great musicians from the Western past. A lot of the times we're scared to do that. If I were to tell you that I'm going to give you an assignment from Boccaccio's Decameron, you would probably think, oh my goodness, I'm going to get a quiz on this tomorrow morning at 9:00. How am I ever going to cope with it? Because that stuff is so highbrow and I am so lowbrow. I could never hope to scale the cliff. Well, you know something? If you pick up the Decameron, I'm just using that as one example from the 14th century.
Mm-hmm.
If you pick up a good translation of the Decameron, I guarantee you in 10 minutes you'll be hooked by the thing. Why? Because Boccaccio was writing it for people just like you. He wasn't writing it for professors.
Yeah.
He wasn't writing it for people coasting along at the 30,000-foot intellectual level. No, because there really aren't that many people there. But Boccaccio is writing this as a chronicle of what he went through. And the same thing is true of all the great writers. The great literature that Hankins and I examine in these books and offer you examples from, they're really like those small samples of great dishes that you might get at a fair, let's call it a restaurant fair. You go there and the restaurants have these little samples of the best cooking that they offer. All right, that's what these books are. We're going to give you the best samples of the Western tradition. And what you're going to find is, hey, this stuff was written for us. Because yeah. It was.
Yeah, their audience was regular people. My mother was a professional cellist, and my mother believed that, and she was correct, that music spoke to everyone. You didn't need to know mm-hmm. who the composer was. Like, my brother used to fall asleep all the time, and we were horrified because here we were sitting right below. She played first chair, and we were sitting right below the cello section, and here my brother's out cold. And she just always smiled, and she said, he's enjoying it in his own way. And so, you know, musicians see that, historians see that, and I think sometimes we don't spend enough time with all of you.
Well, I think sometimes those of us who are part of the professoriate sometimes make more grief than we need to. Sometimes what we really have to do is remember that what we're doing is we're introducing strangers to each other. Mm. We're introducing people today to people they've never met from the past. And if you were in a position like that, if you were about to introduce to, you know, someone who lives down the hall or next door, someone, let's say, from perhaps Nepal, if you were going to introduce to one of your neighbors, how would you go about doing it?
Yeah.
And as soon as you put it that way, that's really the task that Hankins and I have set for ourselves in this book. How do we introduce you to a treasure? If I were to tell
Ellen,
you,
I hate to unceremoniously end our chat, but the radio is going to do it for us. But I really do want to pick this up and do this again because there's so much more to discuss. And we really appreciate you. The Golden Thread, The History of Western Tradition. You can find all the information about our guest in the book at WeThePeopleRadio.us.